time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. So Solomon begins this new section by declaring that for every matter, there is a season and time under heaven. You know, that statement serves as kind of like the header or the introduction to some of the most well-known words in the Bible. You know, the birds, not the animals, but the rock band, with their 1965 rendition with Turn, 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 has stamped these words on our memories. And this beautiful poem not only goes well to music, but it was perfectly made by having seven lines, which is the Hebrew number for completion. Each line has two couplets, and each couplet gives the two extremes of a situation. You know, grammatically, these are called merisms, in which the two extremes are given, and they include everything in between. The alpha and the omega, the high and the low, from head to toe. All of those merisms dealing with the polar opposites and including everything between them. Thus, Solomon, both by what he wrote and how he wrote, he's giving the whole range of the activities we have in life. His poem completely captures every season and time of life. And he starts his list with the quintessential issue encompassing life, birth, and death. That's the two extremes. And as we go through, we'll notice that these are descriptions of life and not prescriptions. In this case, unless Christ returns or you consider the supernatural exceptions of Elijah and Enoch, everyone is going to be born and everyone is going to die. It's appointed for man once to die and then the judgment. Solomon gives then three couplets that deal with our activities, either in creating something or destroying. Thus, there's a time to plant and there's a time to uproot the plants. Now, this could be a literal description of agriculture, that in the springtime you plant, and in the autumn you harvest. Yet with this couplet and some others, the Bible also uses these terms figuratively. Thus, Jeremiah 1:10 says, "See, I have set you this day over the nations and over the kingdoms to pluck up and to break down, to destroy and to build and to plant." You know, we figuratively still use this language. We might say, we're setting down our roots. Or, we were uprooted and taken to another location. Along with those, he says, there's a time to kill and a time to heal. You know, we may wish that peace always worked. But sometimes, robbers attack or soldiers invade. And in self-defense, you must kill or be killed. A time to break down and a time to build up. The building needs expansion, so you have to tear a wing down so you can make it bigger. The barn that sustained generations of life is now leaning perilously and must be removed. Or in other words, he's saying, in a normal life, there are times we begin new ventures, and there are times we have to end old ones. Solomon shifts from our activities then to our emotions, for there's a time to weep and a time to laugh. You may remember in 2:2, chapter 2, verse 2, he said that laughter is madness and folly, because there he was saying laughter was used to avoid life. Yet now he's not giving a positive or negative outlook on laughter. Rather, he just merely observes that sometimes in life we guffaw. Sometimes we chuckle. Sometimes we giggle. We may wish, though, that everything was always merry, but sometimes the reality is, we weep. As Keith noted last week, sometimes we get a call and our whole life immediately flips from joy to sorrow. A call not that we planned or hoped for, but a call that has the key to the house of our life. It unlocks the door and walks in uninvited. Well, having considered our activities and our emotions, he now considers our relationships, for there's a time to embrace and a time to cease embracing. Your loved one is dying, and you give them one last embrace, and then it's time to cease from embracing. But these aren't all negative, because a new child, a new grandchild, and it's time to begin embracing. From relationships, Solomon turns to reflect on our possessions by saying there's a time to seek and a time to lose, or more literally, destroy. You know, though the hoarders and minimalists may disagree, we all know there's times in life where you have to go, you know what? The plate's broken, throw it out. You know what? We actually need to buy some stuff so that we're ready for winter. Likewise, in a culture that made their own clothes, there's a time to tear, there's a time to sew. You may wish to only ever make new garments, but sometimes you have to undo an old one and tear a previously made shirt, curtain, or sheet. In a fallen world, possessions don't last, and so we're constantly seeking and removing. We're fixing and we're creating. No matter how high a quality you buy, the course of time will rust, rot, and one of the worst in a first world culture, we may have things go out of style, and you have to replace them. The curse of time. To recap, Solomon's given the overarching themes of life, birth, and death, and then he walked through our activities, our emotions, our relationships, possessions, and now he turns to our speech, for there's a time to keep silent and a time to speak. Job's friends and the Apostle Peter would have been wiser to have stayed silent. King David would have been wiser to speak up to Adonijah, his son, rather than never having said a word against him. You know, we need the wisdom because we need to know that there are times, as Proverbs 26:4 says, to answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him yourself. But then it says, answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. Having considered all these other areas of life, Solomon concludes by returning to relationships by saying, there's a time to love and a time to hate. This world is filled with wonderful relationships, things and people that we love. And we wish that in our house, we only let in the guest of love. But actions and attitudes that we must hate come barging uninvited into our home. Just as God hated when the Canaanites sacrificed their children to gods, so we must hate when people, even when we do things that are destructive to other people. We wish evil would not invade, but when it does, we must heed Psalm 97:10, O you who love the Lord, hate evil. So Solomon then concludes his poem with, there is a time for war and a time for peace. Well, Solomon's going to respond and show us how to respond to this poem in verses 9 through 15. But before we look at that, we have to grasp his point. His point or concern is not one that we often lament. And that is, oh, I just wish I could stop time right now and live in this moment. You know, perhaps it's an age and stage of your family life, and everyone's getting along, and everything's wonderful. And you just say, could we just stop time? This is wonderful. I wish we could stay here. Perhaps it's a time with friends, or it's a vacation, or it's just a nice, relaxing weekend. You're sitting there by the barbecue pit, and you smell the food. You've relaxed all day, and you just say, could we just live in this moment forever? Well, that's a real issue. But it's not the issue being wrestled with by Solomon. Solomon wrestles with control of time and that the seasons of life are outside of our control. We wish we had the keys and that any guest could only enter when we asked them to. But sorrow, death, and a list of other unwanted guests keep unlocking the door and coming right in. No amount of alarm systems, insurance policies, degrees, or effort can keep them out. They're coming, for we are not fully in control of even our own life. You know, we love to declare It's my body. It's my life. It's my family, my home, my money. I can do what I want. You know, we resonate deeply with, I'm the master of my fate. I'm the captain of my soul. Yet just a moment's reflection makes us realize that the ultimate control we think we have is just an illusion. Who here signed up for life? Who sent their parents a message saying, I want to be born? Who picked who your parents were? When you would be born? Where you would be born? What genes they would give you? What talents they would give you? If we can't control the most basic elements that really shape most of our life, why do we think we have ultimate sway over our life? Solomon looks at people who say they're masters of their fate and he says, be real. You know, his poem is a given. It's the reality of life that you alone don't have the keys to decide your seasons and your times. It's the reality that you do have choice over some things. You do get to choose when to plant and when to uproot. Yet it's also the reality that the keys jingle, the front door is opened, and Uncle Joe died of a brain aneurysm. And Solomon wants us to be real about the seasons and times of our life. And part of being real is to realize that under the sun, this isn't necessarily a negative or a positive list. It's just there. Sometimes Uncle Joe's been living in horrible pain for decades, and his death was a mercy. You know, imagine if we didn't die. In this sin-cursed world, that would mean the Stalins and Hitlers would rule forever. Death can be a mercy. The Solomon's poem is not a negative poem or a positive poem. It's a reality poem. For everything, there's a season. And for every time, there is a matter under heaven. Time for every matter under heaven. So to know how we should respond, we have to keep reading. But before that, you have to realize how important it is to come to terms with the fact that you're not in complete control. You know, this is an issue that we deal with from the youngest of ages. All the two-year-old wants is the Duplo blocks to click together. And they won't. And the next thing you hear is rah, and kicking and throwing blocks. All they want is to control life. The teenager just wants to be able to say what they're going to do. So they're not going to talk. Because maybe they can't control everything else, but they can control how much love and affection they show. And as adults, we get a little better of hiding our fear, anxiety, rage, our lack of control. But many an eating disorder has stemmed from just wanting control over one area of my life. I can't control everything else, but I control what I eat. I control my body size. Many an addiction to illicit material has flowed from, no one else loves me, but I can find one image. They love me. They are telling me that I'm great. Many a drug or alcohol addiction has begun with angry despair over life's unwanted visitors. So how should we respond? Is the point that, you know, what we do doesn't matter? So eat, drink, be merry. We're all going to die tomorrow. Is life just basically dumb luck and fate? Well, Solomon doesn't think so, but rather he's going to proclaim next that we live in beautifully orchestrated times. Let's read verses 9 through 15. Beautifully orchestrated times. He says, what gain has the worker from his toil? I've seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in his time. Also, he's put eternity into man's heart so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceive that there's nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. That which is already has been. That which is to be already has been. And God seeks what has been driven away. Well, you may have noticed Solomon here restates his foundational question back from chapter 1, verse 3. What gain has the worker from his toil? He brings this question up again as he considers living in a timed world. Yet we're left wondering, will Solomon answer as he did before from chapter 1:3 to 2:23 when from only under a sun perspective he says, it's all futility? Or is he going to answer like he did in verses 24 through 26 of chapter 2? You know, he mentions God in verse 10 by referring to the business God has given to the children of men. And again, this is referring back. Look again at chapter 1, verse 13. And I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It's an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. You know, was it that Solomon despaired and then in verses 24 through 26 of chapter 2, he gave God a try, as some people said today, and now he's rejected him again? I mean, he's bringing up all the same issues. Well, no. Solomon did not do that because you may have noticed a key difference between chapter 1, verse 13 and here, because he dropped a key word. He no longer called this an unhappy business. Now it's just the business God has given us. And in fact, notice the amazing words of chapter 3, verse 11. He, God, has made everything beautiful in its time. You know, three amazing things flow from this. First, Solomon already proclaimed all his activity was chasing after the wind, futile. Yet now he says God's works, God's activities are beautiful every single time. Not some masterpieces and some, those are in the trash heap. Not that God had some rough drafts and some sketches and he's not really fully developed all of them. No, every single action and decision of God will be beautiful. And second, Solomon realizes that time is not mindless, nor is fate and destiny running of the universe, for it is God who makes all things beautiful. You're not merely the product of time and chance, but rather you were created with purpose by a good and loving creator. Third, and very essential, God's actions are beautiful in their time. You know, to have a good and beautiful life is to have one in which you trust God's hand and timing. You may not always understand or see it, but God's running of this world is as sure as gravity on this earth. You know, will we trust not only his actions, but his timing? Was Jesus late in the healing of Lazarus who died? Was God running a little behind when the disciples caught no fish all night? Should God have parted the Red Sea before the Egyptians even came? And we know in every single circumstance it's no. God's timing was perfect for his glory and also for our good. There's a problem though. And in fact, it's a God-created problem. It's stated in the middle of the section, verse 11, God has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. Or to put it another way, God made us to want to see the big picture of what's going on in time and eternity. But by our own efforts, reflections, and considerations, we can't do it. It's like being told to describe a 300-foot mural, but only being allowed to stand 2 inches from it. Well, from 2 inches, you could go, well, I see something green. It's maybe a tree. If you backed up, you would see, well, yes, that's a tree, but it's part of a forest that's next to a mountain that has a valley, and there's a village, and then you could see the whole thing. And yet God, though he's put eternity in our hearts, only allows us to see our moment in time. And so Solomon's saying we don't have the eternal perspective to put everything in place. God has put eternity into our finite hearts, so we want to see the whole thing, but God has not given us that perspective. However, Solomon recognizes that just because we can't see the whole thing doesn't mean we give up on the whole enterprise. Rather, we can do as Psalm 31 declares, which Keith read earlier, But I trust in you, O Lord. I say, you are my God. My times are in your hand. Solomon, even without perceiving eternity, could say God makes all things beautiful in their time because he could perceive two realities. Notice the beginning of verse 12 and 14. They begin the same way. I perceived, verse 12, from I perceive that there is nothing, or verse 14, I perceive that whatever God. And what he's telling us in verses 12 through 13 is how we should respond. And then in verses 14 and 15, he's telling us why we should respond this way. So first, verse 12, he perceived how we should respond to our lack of control of time. And Solomon gives three things we should do, with the first and the third being very similar. First and third, he says, man should be joyful as long as he lives. And third, eat and drink and take pleasure in his toil. Now, continuing as he did in chapter 2, verse 25 and 26, he says that man should enjoy the basic pleasures of eating, drinking, and finding pleasure in our task. In fact, these are God's gifts to us. In other words, rather than always longing for another time and season, take the season that you're currently in and enjoy it. Yes, every season has positives and negatives. But if you'll pray and seek to see the good in it, I promise you can. You all know optimist and pessimist. This is a great dinner. Yeah, but we're going to have to do the dishes. Well, at least we have dishes we can wash. Well, they're going to break one day. Yeah, you could see everything positive. You could see everything negative. And some people waste their whole life longing for the future or pining for the past. Oh, life will be great when I can finally go to school. Life will be great when I make it to junior high. Life will be great when I can drive. Life will be great when I'm out of this house. Life will be great when I get married. Oh, life will be great when I have kids. When the kids are in school. When the kids are out of the house. Oh, life will be great when they're married. Oh, when they have grandkids, life will be... When we could just get all the family together again, life's going to... And you're always looking to the future. And at some point you start going, actually, what? Oh, if we could just return, if we could just... And Solomon says, don't long for the future. Don't pine for the past. Enjoy this season. Enjoy your next meal with whoever's there. Don't focus on who's not there. And give thanks to God for the goodness of it. Enjoy your current work, whether that's being a student, a homemaker, a salesman, a retiree. Each of those has struggles and burdens. But each of those also has blessings. They can be beautiful in their time if you see them as a gift from God, in which you uniquely get to represent God and live for God in that work. So, take time to smell the roses. And realize that today, with all its burdens and all its blessings, is a gift from God. Second, he says in verse 12, the way we should respond is that mankind should do good as long as he lives. You know, the doing good here is tied to the beautiful work of our Creator and his character. It's loving your neighbor as yourself. It's seeking to be a blessing to others. It's speaking the truth in love. It's showing mercy and justice. Now notice that Solomon did not say we respond by merely thinking about doing good or planning that one day I'm going to do that in the future when the time's just right. Do good now. In this season God has given you. Yes, one day you might have more time. One day you might have more money. One day you might be able to help them more. But help them with whatever you could do today. So with whatever time, talent, and resources you have today, do good. Well, Solomon not only perceived in verse 12 and 13 how to respond, but he also perceived in verse 14 why to respond this way. And he gives three truths that anchor his belief that God's work will be beautiful in its time, with the first being that whatever God does endures forever. Now, it seems to me that Solomon is going back and looking at his past negative perspective under the sun and seeing it in a new light when considered with God in mind. Thus, rather than his frustration in chapter 1, verse 11, or chapter 2, verse 16, where he said, there's no lasting remembrance of people what they do, now he says, but God's actions, those are going to be remembered forever. Now, the Hebrew word forever in verse 14 is the same word translated eternity in verse 11. In other words, the very thing our hearts long for, eternity and forever, are the things God does. Now, God's actions are permanent, enduring, and forever, and they'll never need improvement. Whereas our actions are bound in this time and washed away like footprints on the seashore, God's actions are indelibly stamped on time and eternity. That leads to the second anchor point for Solomon's belief in God's works being beautiful in their time is that, he says, nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. In other words, when we back up one day and no longer have that 2-inch perspective on the mural, but God gives us the 300-foot perspective, we'll say, it was all perfect. Your friends, I believe this is saying that there will be a time when we can see at least aspects of the end from the beginning. And at that point, we will marvel. If God had put just one more dash of joy, if you just put one smaller pinch of mourning, life would not have been as beautiful. There'll be no second guessing, no suggestions for how God could have improved, corrected, or enhanced our life or the life of the billions of other believers. No, we will stand, or more likely fall down on our face, in wonder, amazement, and sheer delight at how everything God does is perfectly beautiful in its time. Now, we know some aspects of life matter on just the right timing. If you add the cream too soon or too late, the caramel's ruined. You know the difference between a good joke and bad joke timing. Timing matters. And God's timing is perfect every single time. Do you believe that? Do I believe that? You know, when you forget something, you run back in your house, and then you get in your car, and then as you're driving, you go, that accident just happened. And if I hadn't forgotten that thing in my house, I would have been in that accident. Or you don't forget, and you get in the accident. Which one of those was God in control of? Both. His timing is perfect. Now, that's not to make us fatalists who think, well, we have no responsibility. We have no control. You're going to be in the accident. You're not going to be in the accident. We're all in the hands of predetermined fate. No, the good shepherd told us in chapter 3, verse 10, he has a business that he expects us to be busy with. He told us in 3:12, we're to do good, which implies we're actually doing the good. In the mystery of providence, we act. Our actions matter, and God is acting too. Not just acting, though, but God's every action is perfectly beautiful in its time. The third anchor point for this belief is that God has done it. Not God and a team of experts. Not God and a council of the gods. Not God and the leading professors in their fields. No, God, who is eternally wise, just, holy, good, and loving, has designed, planned, enacted, and fulfilled all his plans. Thus, since all of this is true, why do we lead our lives wrapped up with what others say about our time and life? And why are we more concerned about what our family will say about our faith than what God will say? Why do we have a rush of anxiety and fear that, oh, if my friends and coworkers find out what I think about this topic, that's going to be really, man, I'm going to be shamed and ridiculed? Or to use Solomon's words, why do we fear man when God does all of this so that we might fear before him? Not that we cower in dread out of out of control God who's going to punish, but that we live in awe of a good and holy and just God who is making all things beautiful in its time. Well, Solomon has one more consideration in verse 15, a reconsideration. And he does it by kind of reframing what he said in chapter 1, verse 9. In chapter 1, verse 9, he says, what has been done is what will be. And what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. And yet, though he begins it similarly, he twists it. Notice what he says in chapter 3, verse 15. That which is already has been, and that which is to be already has been. And God seeks what has been driven away. With God in his perspective, he sees that God lets nothing pass without his verdict. As he'll conclude his book in chapter 12, verse 14, God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. You know, I think verse 15 is metaphorically picturing God on the hunt, pursuing, chasing down, and bringing back all our past events so that one day we'll be commended or condemned for them. Well, if you enjoy sports, you know that there are timed games and task-oriented games. Baseball lasts 9 innings. Golf is 18 holes. You play till those are done. It doesn't matter how long. Basketball and football have a clock, and when the final buzzer sounds, it's over. Well, friends, life is a timed game. None of us are guaranteed 18 holes or 9 innings of childhood, career, and retirement. We only have so much time in the game, and the clock is ticking. And since God only gives us the 2-inch perspective, none of us knows, do we have 5 more minutes, 5 more days, 5 more years, or 50 more years before and life is over. And when the buzzer sounds, it's appointed for man once to die, and then the judgment. And from that judgment will be 2 groups of people, and only one will for all eternity rejoice and say, everything God did was perfectly beautiful in its time. And the only reason they'll be able to say that is not because they did enough good, not because they became religious and started going to church, helping the poor, and doing enough of the right stuff so I can outweigh all the stuff I'm ashamed of. No, the only reason is declared in Mark 1, 14 and 15. Jesus came into Galilee proclaiming the gospel and saying, the time is fulfilled. The kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and believe in the gospel. It's because when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoptions as sons. And this was not that we cleaned up our life, but rather while we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. Christ could do that because he entered into time, and he endured all the seasons of life. He laughed, and he wept. He sought disciples, and he lost a disciple. He loved and hated. He was silent, and he spoke. He was born, and he died. Thus, he knows, not just intellectually, he knows experientially the joys and sorrows of each and every season and time of life. He knows them because he loves you. And he came to live and die for you so that you might know him eternally. And for eternity, he will be crowned King of Kings. And we'll know the truth that we sang earlier. Crown him the Lord of love. Behold his hands and side. Those wounds yet visible above in beauty glorified. In his time, he'll make all things, even the death of his son, beautiful. You know, death did not unlock the door of Jesus' house and enter uninvited into his time. Rather, Jesus entered into time and purposefully invited death into his house. He invited death in and defeated it and rose again so that for time eternal, death will be no more. That there will no longer be a time to weep and to laugh, a time to love and to hate, or a time to live and to die. Rather, due to Christ, we will only laugh, live, and love forever. So friends, time is marching on, and the ever-rolling stream of time will drown you if you fight to control it. Yet, if you will entrust your times in God's hands, the journey will be beautiful. Let's pray. Well, Lord, it's easy to say these things in a room like this, and yet then we go out and we have a flat tire, or someone does something relationally that stings, or we have other sorrows and we wonder, do you know what you're doing? Do you really care for us? Lord, would you help us to trust? Would you help us to believe and know that you will make all things beautiful in their time? That we can entrust our life, we can entrust all our times into your hands. It's in your Son's name we pray. Amen.